Donner has a wonderful sweater on today.
Well, thank my wife.
She's a wonderful woman.
Yes.
Yes, she is.
Makes us look good.
How do you know? I'm sorry. Let's get
We're going to take the bills in order in which we have the testifiers kind of in the room at the time, and there's a couple of representatives that will be here today, and we have one with us right now. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2094 and call Representative Jensen up. And
like me to give a little
if you could just refresh us on what this is about.
Mr. Chairman, this is the third time you've heard this. You've heard this on the 6th and the, well, this is the second time. Today is the 20th. So, this authorizes the Department of Corrections to contract with local governments when requested to assist with security, health care, and other services at jails and juvenile detention facilities. We have two amendments that have been proposed, and that's where we are.
Thank you. Can we distribute those amendments to the committee?
You have the amendments attached in your packets. There's the dash one and the dash two, and then we these are not real complicated. We decided we would get in some practice of hand engrossing these. So we hand engross both amendments into the bill, and that's what you also have attached here in your packet.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to explain our position on House Bill 2094 and on the amendments that you have before you. And I'd like to offer, an apology to the committee. It would have been my preference for the people who are having problems with this bill to have approached us. We would have been happy to have worked with them for these amendments so that we would have been able to expedite it and move it through a little more quickly. As it stands, we have no objection to the amendments. They will not defeat the purpose for which the sheriff in Umatilla County brought this to our attention. It's a good bill this way for our purposes. It will help the local county save some money as they process through the medical services for people who are held in the county jail there. So we would appreciate your support with the amendments as they appear today.
Thank you, Representative. Be assured that you don't owe this committee an apology. Legislative etiquette for all those who are here and might be listening is that if you have something to add to somebody's bill or you have a concern, you probably ought to approach them first before the 11th hour and try to take it on in committee. And the process works better, and there's more preparation that can be involved with it. So we thank you for working with people who had a problem with the bill, even though I don't think you would have had to do that. But I think the bill is clearer now for everyone involved. And is there any questions from the committee of Representative Jensen? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
That is just a work session.
Just a work session?
Yeah.
Should I open a hearing or work session?
Did you open a hearing or work
session? Hearing?
Mm-hmm. Good.
Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2094? Good enough. Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2094.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2094.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2094. Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the dash two amendments.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2094. Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2094 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2094 to the floor. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Walker?
Excuse?
Aye.
Backlund?
Aye.
Leonard?
Excuse.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Knutson?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2894 is declared passed, and we need a carrier. Representative Jensen, would you like to carry your bill?
Sure, thank you.
Thank you. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2094. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill, LC 3437. Mr. Simbridge, you want to tell us a little bit about this?
This relates to licensing fees. It changes the license fees for electrical contractors, electricians. Looks like it's pretty well restricted to electrical licensing. It would take effect July 1st, 2001.
If anybody asks, we forgot. Who brought this forward? Is there anybody here that brought this forward? Somebody's going to talk to me later, I'm sure, but we've received several of these in the last few days, and for the life of me, I can't remember who it was that brought this forward, but I'm sure it's really important at the time, and I totally face it, so.
This guy might know.
He might. He might.
Mr. Chair, in that case, I'd be happy to make a motion as quickly as possible.
All right. Yeah, before anybody signs up.
I'd move LC 3437 be adopted as a committee bill.
Representative Wilson has moved LC 3437 be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and we will close the work session for that purpose. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2220. Mr. Simbridge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2220 has to do with the Commissioner of Labor's responsibility for approving wage payment settlements. This would relieve the Commissioner from those duties if the settlements do not require the employee to relinquish claims for additional or future violations.
We are going to recess the public hearing after all that hard work. We're going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2220. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2500. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2500. Representative Cruz, the representative from God's country, as he likes to be known, has introduced a bill. And Mr. Simbridge, can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yes, House Bill 2500 requires employees to give a written demand for wages to an employer in order for a subsequent wage claim award to include attorney's fees. The bill also allows the employer to avoid liability for the employee's attorney's fees by paying the employee within 10 days of that written demand.
Thank you. Representative Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing me on such short notice. I'm chairing a committee in the basement. We're doing a minor little thing like reinventing the Department of Human Resources. So I appreciate being able to get back there in a reasonable time. Committee members, this is fairly simple, straightforward bill. It's a matter of fairness. It doesn't exclude anybody's right for anything. It just puts another step in the process as far as an employer being informed of an action so that he has a chance to respond before the thing gets to court. It's a very short bill, and my explanation on it is very short. I looked at this purely as a fairness issue, and I'd be willing to answer any questions on it. I think it's fairly self-explanatory, but I would like to close with a quote from Abraham Lincoln, who said, "Discourage litigation. Persuade your neighbors to compromise whenever you can. As a peacemaker, the lawyer has a superior opportunity of being a good man. There will still be business enough." So with that, I would be willing to answer any questions. Like I said, this doesn't limit anybody's ability to recover damages. It just gives us one more opportunity to do something before we enter litigation.
Mr. Cruz, did you talk with Representative Cruz? Did you talk with Mr. Lincoln, and is he supporting the bill?
No, I leave that to some former first ladies to talk with the dead.
Gotcha. Are there any questions for Representative Cruz?
Does it have to be related to this bill?
If possible.
No.
No questions for Representative Cruz?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and we are going to recess our hearing on House Bill 2500 for the purposes of heading back to our public hearing on House Bill 2220. We will reopen that hearing and have Commissioner Roberts come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I hope that the circuitous route we went to get here doesn't get people too confused. This is not one of those issues that the purpose behind which is obvious unless you understand some of the history. Apparently, for a long time, we've had a problem that we weren't aware of until the Court of Appeals was kind of pointed out to us. The law for some time has allowed the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to affirm agreements between employers and employees to waive certain rules. This is related to what Representative Walker asked about when I was here before in our overview about some provisions of the law that require overtime be paid for people who work 10 hours a day in manufacturing, and that we have the ability to waive that for some manufacturers who work shifts where they work 3 days, 12-hour days, and then 3 days off. So that's been established for a long time, and that isn't a problem, apparently, according to the court. What they have done now is read that to require that the commissioner approve any wage settlement relating to settlement on overtime or other types of claims. This arose out of a case that was decided by the Court of Appeals, Vinto versus Versatile Logistics Systems. I won't go into the whole story, but basically what happened in that case was there was an employer who, just as a matter of course, when people left their employee, gave them an extra $1,000 and got them to sign a waiver that they waive any rights they have for overtime or any other things that happen. There was an employee eventually who signed the waiver, got the money, but later discovered that he had been owed overtime, decided the waiver was not appropriate, sued. The circuit court said, you're out of luck, you signed this waiver, got to the Court of Appeals. Now, there may have been a number of issues that would have been, I think, appropriate grounds for setting aside that waiver, not the least of which is that a blanket waiver of unknown rights is generally not enforceable anyway. What the court decided to do was to decide that no, because this waiver had not been agreed to by the Bureau of Labor and Industries, by the commissioner, that therefore would be set aside. In that individual case, that didn't create a problem for us. The problem has been since then, lawyers all over the state have said, we can't enter into any kind of a settlement of back wages or overtime or anything else without getting the labor commissioner to approve it. Our position is that we're not going to simply rubber stamp agreements that we don't have any knowledge or information about. At the same time, we don't have the resources to go and oversee all these private settlements. And so the problem that it has created, and we have, as a matter of fact, not agreed to sign any of those since this decision came down, although we've had several requests. Consequently, people went into those settlements to do that at some risk that down the road, if someone has second thoughts about the deal they made, they can come back and open it up again. Our feeling is that discourages private settlements. It is an unnecessary impediment in the law. We should not be required to review or pass judgment on these agreements, and therefore we came up with this language which says that a settlement between an employer and employee of a known and identified claim, and that's trying to get out of this thing where you waive all rights known and unknown, that if it's a settlement of a known identified claim, that can be entered into provided it does not require the employer or provide for the employee to relinquish a claim for additional or future violations. So we're keeping the current law on prospective waivers of any rights, that those have to come to us and be approved so that we can make sure that it's not a coercive type of arrangement, but that actual settlements of known identified claims can go forward without having to involve us, and the parties will know that the deal will be honored and go and fall into the normal legal principles. And we think that helps to encourage the private settlements and is much more expeditious and a better use of our resources as a government agency, and also allows private parties. And I didn't bring the Abraham Lincoln quote to Representative Cruz, but I think it would apply here as well. But it does help to provide those settlements and doesn't get us into the middle of it.
Thank you. You decided not to ask for more money to try to do all this as opposed to trying to make this simpler. We applaud you for your effort. Any questions for Commissioner Roberts? Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, if this bill had been in effect, would that case that gave rise to the Court of Appeals decision have still required your approval? Or would that have been a legal settlement?
I believe that there were several bases on which that type of a settlement would not have been. I think under the terms of the language we wrote here, since they were not waiving known identified claims, it was a general waiver of all claims, I think it would not be enforceable. I think there also were some problems with how that whole thing came about that might have been, you know, separate apart from us, that could have been used. So I don't think even if this had been in effect, that particular case would have turned out differently.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess I'm not really clear on what a known and identified claim is. Does it have to be one that the employee is specifically waiving in this agreement when they leave?
Well, I would say it's like this. Someone comes back and says, I went and got a lawyer. We think that you owe this person for 20 hours of overtime. And the employer comes back and says, well, our records don't show that. They show that if you didn't work overtime or you only worked 10 hours, and they reach some kind of a compromise settlement, so they get paid for 15 hours of overtime. In theory, that's a waiver of the rest of what that person thought they were entitled to. I think as a practical matter, for the most part, once you reach a settlement, the last thing you want to do is go back and open up and litigate again. But that's the fear and the concern that people have that want to come to us. So what we're talking about here is not so much a waiver as a settlement of a claim. And so a settlement of a claim, even if you're not getting everything that you believe you're entitled to, if you agree to enter into a settlement or compromise, you can do that without having to come and have us approve it.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on 2220? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2220. We will come back to a work session later today on this bill. But I noticed that Representative Close has come, and probably the purpose for her attendance is a bill that she sponsored. And it's House Bill 2672. And so we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2672.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2672 requires the Child Care Division of the Employment Department to credit child care providers for study of child care training media as fulfillment of registration renewal training requirements.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Chair Knopf and members of the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. Mid-Valley Child Care Associates of Lynn and Benton County, a family home care organization since 1980, would recommend that House Bill 2672 be passed with added provisions to satisfy the training requirements for registered family home child care facilities. You may ask, why do family home child care providers need these alternatives to satisfy the training requirements? Parents work around-the-clock jobs, many on weekends, and must have child care during these hours. Family home child care providers must operate their business to accommodate parents who work this type of schedule. The hours and days a family home child care provider must be open makes it nearly impossible for some providers to attend classes or get training outside of the home as currently required by law. And we did pass a lot of this last session, if you remember. The alternatives in House Bill 2672 would help providers get the required training and provide them some relief. They would recommend adding workshops given by family child care associations and other organizations, which we have added to the list of training requirement alternatives. The question of documentation and proof of training for alternatives has been raised. And they suggest the following: reading materials, list the title and author of the book, make a copy of the cover or title page of the book, list where the book came from, e.g. library purchase borrowed, list date started and date finished. Write a short outline of what you've learned from the book, not more than one page. Television programs, they recommend listing the name of the program, the title, the channel, the number of the total hours it was on, cut out the listing of the program from the advertising section, save it, write a short outline. Third, classes, seminars, workshops offered by childcare or other organizations, verification or certification of the training offered, sponsor's name, date attended, hours attended. Videotapes, name of the video and producer, hours of the video, date watched, write a short outline of what you've learned from the video, not more than one page. Internet websites, URL of the site, address, date read, hours spent reading it, write a short outline. We would like to thank the chairman and committee members for listening to our testimony. This is written by Eileen Rasmussen, by the way, and Sandy Chenning, and would recommend that House Bill 2672 be passed with our amendment and recommendation for documentation and proof of training. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Close? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in the closing lines of your testimony, you mentioned recommending it be passed with our amendment. Do we have that amendment today?
Chair Canope, Representative Merkley, I saw that line as well, and the only amendment I know of is one that Tom Olson is going to be offering, which I've not seen, and I assume they're referring to that. But I do not know what it says.
Okay, thank you. Additional question?
Follow-up?
In the way this would be implemented, you mentioned as you were reading the write a report not to exceed one page and so forth, is that would be accomplished in regulations that implement this?
Chair Canope, Representative Merkley, yes, I believe that this would be submitted during the rulemaking process. This group, when we had rules last session, when this bill was passed last session, they had input into the rulemaking process, written input.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. Representative Close, I know we have a witness coming from the Child Care Division, so we can probably clarify, but do you know, have these requirements taken effect and been a hardship yet on providers, or is it just anticipated that they will be?
Chair Knope, Representative Rosenbaum, we had a lot of testimony before Human Resources when the two bills that were going through last time. We tried to amend, this group asked for amendments, and I tried to accommodate them as best we could. However, it was the end of session, and it's their feeling that they wanted to add further alternatives, and that's why they've come forward with this. They did amend last session.
Mr. Chair,
perhaps
a dangerous question, but do you think it's possible this change could be accomplished by rulemaking instead of changing the law?
Representative Pope and Representative Rosenbaum, it certainly could. However, my experience has been that the agency, they seem to be on a course when I went to through this process with them, and I did not find them that accommodating to us. So we feel the need to have to have input in this manner.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Cross.
Thank you.
Looks like next up we have Tom Olson. And committee members, we did receive some testimony, written testimony from Berlina Crosley, and there is an amendment that they would like to have added, and I believe that's part of the second page or the back page of what we would have of that testimony. Mr. Olson, are you bringing that forward? Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill. For background, and some of you I know are familiar with this, remember Representative Leonard was intimately involved in the legislation that passed last session, and we felt that 8 hours of training every 2 years was a fair and reasonable amount of training that could be accomplished by a family child care provider. And we believe that there are places in the state where training is not readily available, and it's our intention, as in the division, to make training available to child care providers in the way that they can get it the most conveniently. However, We do take slight issue with sort of a self-reporting system of saying that you've read a magazine article or watched a television program and self-reporting on that. We think it would not be a hardship for child care providers if they were to take classes, which are available through child care resource and referrals, through community colleges, through the Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children, through provider workshops. These classes are offered in the evenings. They're offered on the weekends. And again, the providers have a total of 2 years before they renew to meet 8 hours of training requirements. 8 hours of training can basically be achieved in one workshop or on one weekend. So we believe that whereas the training requirement as written in statute is not unreasonable, that we do want providers to have the flexibility to be able to use the internet, to be able to use certain other forms of media to get the training, but what we would respectfully request is that that training be somehow documented. It's difficult for our very few staff to be put in the position of trying to read someone's outline of training that they wrote after watching a television program. Basically, what they would have time to do would be to look at a documentation certificate and to note that that training has been achieved. And so we would request that that the particular amendment that we are offering that basically says that completion of the training must be documented by a certificate from the training organization, program, or publication that includes the name of the organization that provided the training, the subject matter, and the hours of credit. Now, there are very reputable child care magazines, for instance, that that offer home study programs. And you can do you can read an article, and they have a form that you fill out, a short test that you take, you send it in, and they'll send you back a training certificate. That's perfectly fine. There are internet classes that are available, and that will do the same thing. And all we're asking is that documentation be a part of the process. Part of what we're trying to achieve here, professionalization of the child care industry for many reasons. One being that that increased professionalization leads to higher pay for child care providers eventually. And number two, of course, children are being better taken care of by trained providers. So we feel that the amendment that we're offering is certainly within the intent of giving the child care providers the maximum amount of flexibility possible while giving us some tangible documentation that represents that they've taken the classes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Olson, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, what's the difference between a certified individual and a registered individual as far as credentialing
Representative,
or training, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, certification is a fairly rigorous process. We have three types of what would be known as regulated child care facilities in Oregon. We have certified child care centers, we have certified child care group homes, and we have registered child care providers. Certified centers and group homes receive annual announced and unannounced inspections. They agree to take increased training requirements, 15 hours a year, and to, in cases, of course, the child care centers have to meet fairly stringent requirements in terms of facilities, staff and to child ratios. Registered family child care providers can take up to 10 children in their home. You don't have to be registered if you care for three or fewer children, or if you care for children just from one family. But if you're a small business that's going to care for four children or more, up to 10, then you should be required to be registered as a child care provider with a child care division.
Excuse me.
Paula,
please. Sorry. Mr. Chair, so did I understand correctly, to be certified you have 15 hours of training a year, and to be registered you have 8?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, to be registered you have 8 hours of training every 2 years.
Every 2 years.
Right.
And continue, please, Mr. Chair. And if you're certified, your facility and methodology or whatever application of what you've learned is inspected, but if you're registered, you're not inspected. If you have 10 kids.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, up until last session, that was in fact the case, that there was no formal inspection of any kind of family child care. That did change last session with the passage of legislation, House Bill 2241. And as a result of that legislation, newly registering family child care providers received what's called an on-site health and safety review. And prior to receiving that review, they have to have documentation that their training, that they have to get up front now, has been achieved. And then, of course, there's a visual inspection of the facility to make sure it's a safe place.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to be sure I understand this. So certified 15 hours of training a year or retraining, and inspections sometime during each year.
That's correct.
Registered, that's 8 hours of training every 2 years, and a recurrent, I'm assuming, also a recurrent training like pilots. And inspection one time when you open, or maybe any time during the year unannounced.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the inspection is only when you open, and it is not repeated unless we receive a serious complaint from a member of the public or someone that alleges that there are things going on that we need to look at, in which case we do immediately conduct an investigation.
Paul?
Yes, please. And is there a charge for this registration and this certification?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it's $30 for 2 years.
For both of them?
That's correct.
$30?
Not for registration. I mean for certification. I'm sorry. For registration, it's $30 for 2 years. For certification, it is based on the number of slots that you have. For instance, you pay a certain number, like $2 a slot if you have. If you're certified for 100 children, you would pay that amount times $2.
So $200 a year?
Right.
And the registered individual is $30, Mr. Chair.
Every 2 years, that's correct.
Every 2 years.
Yes.
One last question.
Follow.
And would this license include a very serious situation that came out of our Transportation Committee? Does this certification and this training include the transport of these children?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it does.
Thank you.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, currently a child care provider, a worker, has this 8 hours of training. When that is completed, a certificate is given. Is there any interactive work that the child care provider has to go through in that 8 hours? Participatory type things, question-answer type things, written answers to questions, that sort of thing.
Representative Canope, Representative Backlund, there is not a specific requirement that there be a necessarily an interactive training situation. We do certainly encourage that, and the reason we do is that child care tends to be a very isolated profession, and it's far better for providers to get together with their peers and get training together and just talk about what they're experiencing, because if you can imagine being in a room with 10 children for 8 to 9 hours a day, you can get some idea of how they do need peer support. And so we do, whenever possible, at least request that they take the training in classroom situations. But because Oregon is a rural state, and because there are areas in the state that don't have access to the training that some areas do, we're willing to extend that to accommodate other types of media, if that's necessary for the training to be achieved.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested in listening to Representative Close's testimony, because in their suggestions, write a short outline, this is under the reading materials, write a short outline of what you learned from the book, not more than one page. Going on television programs, write a short outline of what you learned from the television program, not more than one page. Same with videotapes, and same with the internet website. In many ways, that's really pretty good, because the person taking the training has to react to what he or she has seen, and has to analyze, and has to do some thinking and some writing. And that's really not bad. So it's not automatic. I don't think we can presume automatically that what we have now is necessarily better than what House Bill 2672 suggests. It is a thought. Thank you, Representative Backlund. Any other questions from the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, it's nice to meet you in person. We had a conversation a couple weeks ago on the phone. in my line of work, we have to get continuing education credits, much like attorneys do. 30 credit hours every 2 years. We do self-reporting, but we also have to attend seminars and get documentation that we attended. Is that something that's required as part of this training now? You just get documentation that you've attended these programs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, what we're doing, what by policy right now, we require that that documentation be provided of the 8 hours of training. We just haven't been able to go to the step of, and with the advice of the Child Care Commission, to take the step of going to self-reporting.
My next question is, it takes generally, in fact, I can tell you that I have not yet received my recertification yet, even though I sent it in over a year ago. Does your agency take that long?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I certainly hope not. We try to, we're very cognizant of the need for child care businesses to stay in business, and we try to facilitate that as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, my final question. I'd just like to enlighten the good representative from Yamhill County about a bill that is coming forward this session, the Senate bill that would increase the safety checks to every year for all daycare providers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I have not seen that concept.
Well, the Child Care Commission came by my office, and it would extend what we did last session to new daycare providers. But now this one would extend it to all daycare providers. Is this ringing a bell now?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Walker. What this is that right now, because the resources couldn't be found last session to do reviews on all providers, that basically they were restricted to just newly registering providers. And so what the new legislation will do is to make all providers subject to health and safety reviews every 2 years before their registration is renewed.
Which we'll discuss when that comes over, because it's a great thing. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, did you have another question?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson, and we could discuss these at another time so I don't take up the whole committee, but I'm concerned that if the training includes CPR and first aid, I'm concerned if, you know, if there's a training for giving medicines to children and what that training program is. We just discussed that in our Representative Backlund's Education Committee today, which is a big issue. And I'm concerned about the policies for, you know, transporting these children, in that children are being transported in vans from these child care centers without any safety harnesses of whatsoever, and I think this is sick and needs to stop immediately. And then I'm concerned about what is your going through the procedures, how do you determine if someone is fit to be, you know, the running this child care center?
Mr.
So I'll just see you later, but I think those are all very important. And since this is a big business now, I mean, it's critical for, you know, since the majority of our families are, you know, both working parents. Serious issues. Thank you for being concerned.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you. Actually, one question came to my mind. I was, Mr. Chair, if I might. Sorry.
Representative Walker.
I was trying to look through the bill. When you get a certification that these folks have attended these programs, mm-hmm. do they have to get that notarized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, no, we do not require notarization.
All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, again, we're trying to make it as easy on the providers as possible. This is a new requirement for them, and they've pretty much operated as with absolutely no intervention in their businesses before. And so we're really trying to make this something that they can do easily and without any undue hardship.
I would suggest that if you relax these requirements, that I would want to see a notary certificate with that. You can get it at any bank or credit union, and that way the person, if they're watching television or doing this program, they certify that they have indeed done this. Otherwise, I probably won't be supportive of the bill. We do that for our certification. It's a very simple process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2672? Don't see anyone else out there. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2672. We had a request for the amendment. I would like to be able to get that in draft form, and I would like to have Representative Close have time to talk with Mid Valley Child Care Associates to make sure, in fact, that is the amendment that was talked about in your testimony. And we can bring this back for a work session. So is the amendment done? Couple other housekeeping issues. If you're here for the work session on House Bill 2523, I hesitate to mention this because I'm afraid I'm going to clear half the room. But we're not going to go to work session on that bill today to move it to any other particular committee. We may, however, keep it on the calendar week after week to require attendance. Just to keep your interest up. But we will not go to work session on that today for the possible referral to the Commerce Committee. Let's go back to, let's see, we still have enough members. Let's go back to House Bill 2220. I think we're going to lose Commissioner Roberts if I do this. So I'm going to go to work session on House Bill 2220. I don't think there were any amendments to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard.
I move House Bill 2220 to do pass recommendation to the floor.
Representative Leonard moves House Bill 2220 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Bowman?
Aye.
Shacklin?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Merkley?
Representative Merkley, we're currently voting on House Bill 2220, and your name has been called.
Commissioner Roberts.
Mr. Chair, are we including the amendment recommended?
There is no amendment to this. This is the Labor Commissioners.
Oh.
2220. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
No.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2220 is declared passed, and I would entertain another motion. If the committee so desires.
Mr. Chair, I move, we move House Bill 2220 to the consent calendar. In respect of Commissioner Roberts, who has now provided this written testimony, of which I'm so grateful.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Not wanting to carry any more bills out of this committee, has moved House Bill 2220 to the consent calendar. Is there any objection to this being placed on the consent calendar? Seeing no or objection, the word. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2220. Looks like we are back to House Bill 2500, and we're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2500. Assemblage just for our amusement. This bill again was?
This is the one that requires employees to give a written demand for wages to an employer in order for a subsequent wage claim award to include attorney's fees. This is Representative Cruz's bill. Allows employers to avoid liability for employees' attorney's fees by paying the employee within 10 days of that written demand.
Thank you. As you recall, you just finished up with Representative Cruz. President Lincoln apparently had supported the bill.
Open to him.
And our testimony list includes Michael Dale. He'll come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, boy, as a lawyer, I hate to take on Abe Lincoln.
Give it a shot.
We don't have any. My name is Michael Dale. I'm from the Oregon Law Center. I've represented farm workers in Oregon for about 23 years. Mostly, a good percentage of our cases really have to do with wages and wage collection. We don't have any fundamental opposition to the idea that before you get sued, you ought to get a letter saying, you know, if you don't pay what's owed, we're going to sue you, and get a chance to react to that. That's basically good practice, courtesy, and common custom in the legal profession, and that's generally our practice in the legal services world. There are occasionally, not very many times, but once in a while, you'll have a client that comes in on the day before the statute of limitations is going to run, in which case you go ahead and file the bill, I mean, file the case, and then call up the other side and see if you can work something out quickly. In that kind of case, generally, there wouldn't be much in terms of attorney's fees demanded. But those things having been said, we do have some fundamental problems with the bill as drafted. There's a reason why Oregon has always required a fairly short time period within which to pay workers. And actually, for farm workers, it's 48 hours unless the work ends by mutual consent or the worker's given advance notice he's leaving, in which case it's the last day of work that the worker's supposed to be paid on. Workers frequently have to leave town. They may be en route to another job site. They may need the last paycheck in order to pay gas to get to the next place. In any event, it's not very convenient for them to stick around and wait for a paycheck for wages where, you know, they're consuming their what money they do have with living expenses here while they're waiting to get paid. For workers who are more stable, if you're leaving one job, it may be that you don't have another, and you may need your last paycheck for those reasons. In order to encourage people to pay promptly and on time, Oregon's law has a policy at 652.150 that says the day after you should have paid, if you didn't and if it was willful, you owe an extra day's wages. And that keeps happening every day up to 30 days until you pay or you're sued. So what this bill does, in effect, is as a practical matter, even though those penalties theoretically would accrue, would cut off the ability, as a practical matter, of most workers to collect those penalties, because it's not clear that when payment is demanded and payment is tendered, that what has to be tendered is the full amount of unpaid wages plus the full amount of accrued penalties that have accrued up to that point in time. It may be that you can read the bill to say offering to pay the unpaid wages at that point would be enough, in which case there'd be no attorney's fees, in which case the worker would be left without an effective way to collect the penalties unless they were lucky enough to be able to get into a legal services office, and those resources are quite limited. So we're concerned about that, and we're slightly concerned about the statute of limitations question. That could be remedied, actually, by amending the bill to say that when that demand letter that's called for goes out, that tolls the statute of limitations for 30 days. That would meet that objection. And the other objection would be if the employer is required to tender not only the unpaid wages but any penalties that have accrued up to that point, with those amendments, I could support the bill. Some people have raised with me another question, which isn't a problem for us in our practice, but may be a problem for workers trying to enforce the rights on their own, and that is a concern that the mailing by certified mail return receipt requested may be too technical for lay people to be expected to follow, and it might be better just to say you've mailed it, and if you mailed it by return receipt, then you've got proof of mailing, but not require that as a technical matter if, in fact, you can show by other means that you've mailed the letter to the employer. That would be my comment on the bill. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Deck?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Leonard, did you have a question?
Well, it's kind of a comment that I'd be interested in hearing you respond to, but I think it's your comments, I believe, go to the concerns I have, and that is this seems to fundamentally change how these disputes are resolved. if we agree to these amendments to ORS 652, it would seem to me that it puts a number of employees in a very untenable position of having wages owed to them not paid simply because they may not have submitted something in writing demanding payment of those wages. And I guess I have some concerns that we're establishing loopholes here for employers that may attempt to not pay wages that they legitimately owe.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead and respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, I have that concern as well. I'm trying to be mindful of the interest that Representative Cruz is raising. We're talking about liability for attorney's fees, not liability for the penalties themselves. And as long as there's an effective way to collect the penalties, either because the employer pays them or because you have access to a lawyer to help you collect them, then our concerns are probably addressed. But under this bill as drafted, as an attorney in private practice, I would wonder whether I would have any way to get compensated for my time if I took on this case and the worker couldn't pay me. So I think that you may be cutting off access to the courts in those cases where the employer sits on the claim for wages until he gets something in writing, sits another 10 days, and then pays the unpaid wages but doesn't pay the accrued penalty damages, which could be a whole month's pay at that point. I mean, it works best if people just simply pay when they're supposed to pay, and there's strong incentives in the law and should be to do that under existing law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical question about this requirement for return receipt. It notes that the return receipt can be either to the residence and or place of business of the employer. Why would the return receipt, am I missing something here? Why would the return receipt go to the employer rather than back to the plaintiff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I believe probably the idea was that the certified mail goes to the residence or place, and return receipt is the kind of registered mail intended. It's an awkwardness in the drafting.
I see. Clarified. Okay. That raises my other question then. So with clarification that the certified mail would go to the employer, which does make sense, then the question is, where does the return receipt go? And somebody, I think, anticipated my question by mentioning farm workers, and that was the issue I wanted to get to, was the problems that are raised for people who have no permanent address or are working from farm to farm to farm as to how they would receive such a receipt and have it available to press their claim. Is that an issue you've thought about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, at that point, a farm worker who's moved on is going to have to be represented in order, as a practical matter, to collect the wages. If they've done everything they could do and are at the point of having to write a formal letter, return receipt requested, at that point, they're going to have an attorney if they're going to collect the wages. I think, and the return receipt could be sent to one of our offices. It raises a whole series of problems, and one question I'd raise for the committee, I'm trying to be constructive in terms of figuring out what the critical interests are, but this statute has been on the books for a lot of years, and one might raise the question whether it's sufficiently broke that it needs fixing. I mean, maybe if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I'm not sure what brought forward the necessity of an amendment to the bill. I suppose that one thing to do to avoid these problems is just not amend the bill, and I would support that with careful attention to close amendments that would limit its adverse effects, I could support the bill under those circumstances. We could not support the bill as it's currently drafted.
Mr. Chair, one more question. You noted that really in order to accomplish this letter, a person would have to be represented due to the practical challenges. And yet, if the employer responded to the letter, there would be no payment in the settlement for the representation. So does this mean that a farm worker, for example, would have to pay for representation out of his or her own pocket? Or simply that people would refuse to provide representation, knowing that they wouldn't have the client wouldn't have a way of paying for services.
Representative Markley, to the extent that we were representing the farm worker, then we would provide that service and not expect compensation from the farm worker. The resources in the legal services world are limited, and there are places in the state where they're not readily available. In those circumstances, they'd have to find someone who would represent them under those conditions. And that would either be something that the lawyer would need to do pro bono, or that the worker would have to pay for out of their pocket.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale.
Thank you.
Is the premise on which this is written the fact that in our summary it says it's relative to subsequent wage claim awards? So whereas we don't see that in the bill.
Which bill are you on? 2500?
Uh-huh.
Which line?
On the summary.
Oh, the summary.
Where the summary
subsequent wage
speaks to subsequent wage claim awards. I mean, I'm thinking that this is the purpose of Representative Cruz's bill. For example, you know, if an employee quits on you or is terminated, it can go either way, where we have made a, you know, best effort to pay them what we feel at that moment records show, but just like the one with the state right now for which we're responsible for many millions of dollars, all of a sudden somebody files a suit without notifying you that they have a concern. I felt this whole purpose was to mitigate that happening in a subsequent claim of which, you know, the employer may not even be aware or feel they were responsible, like the one with the state and the, as we know, that exists to say that costs many millions. But I don't think that's what this refers to. But I can see where this could be subsequent claims where an individual would go to attorney and say, wait a minute, you know, I worked 5 holidays, you know, and I did. I settled, you know, I got paid, you know, $1,000 till the end of the week. But yet now I've talked to other people and find out I should have also been paid for every holiday I've ever worked for the past 24 years, and goes and files a suit without notifying, you know, the employer. I felt that this was an effort to mitigate having to file a lawsuit if the employer were aware that the individual feels that he's entitled. And this may have not been his thinking at the time of dismissal or the day he quit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I started my testimony by saying that we have no objection to the idea that lawyers could, should, even must file or write some kind of demand letter prior to filing suit, so long as it doesn't jeopardize someone's claim under the statute of limitations. That's not my fundamental opposition. We routinely, in these kinds of cases, and I think most attorneys routinely in these kinds of cases, would send a letter prior to filing suit. And the reason you do that is because it saves you and the client time, effort, and money to do it that way, because it may be that the person will look at it and say, oh, you're right, you're entitled to that money, and why put everyone to the time and expense of doing that, of filing and responding to a lawsuit, if in fact you can resolve it amiably. that's the way that this all should work, and I'm not offering objections to it working that way. I'm just simply saying that in the course of doing that, we ought not extend the 48-hour period that one now has to pay a farm worker to 48 hours plus 10 days plus however long it took to get to an attorney and write the letter to start with. That's my only opposition to the bill.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Please.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Mr. Dale, I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, once that employee has contacted an attorney, the attorney's fees start, right? Or do you do this pro bono?
Representative Nelson, our services are provided at no charge to the worker. Attorneys in private practice may have different kinds of relationships. They may accept a case like this on a contingent fee, whereby basically they're looking to be paid out of whatever is recovered, including whatever attorney's fees awarded by the court. And they may not be charging the client up front. They may be charging by the hour. That's between the client and the lawyer.
So, may I finish, Mr. Chair? So what I'm getting at is I perceive what Representative Cruz was attempting to do was to have this individual notify the employer directly without attorneys being involved, because I don't care which way they're involved other than maybe, I mean, they're all paid somehow. And so there's dollars once you call an attorney. You know, it's like the only way to do business with an attorney is not to, you know, kind of one of those. But what I'm just saying is I felt that what he was asking was, you know, for there to be some means where an individual could contact the employer pre-attorney so that if a situation existed like this, it could be resolved before, you know, racking up buku contingency fees or any other kind, or, you know, $200 an hour or whatever, or cost charging state funds or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I can assure you that most workers don't like attorneys much more than, or to deal with attorneys much more than you've indicated. Attorneys actually are all bad people. What about Abe Lincoln? But anyway,
Mr. Chair, I need to say I've not expressed attorneys are bad. I'm just saying there's a fee
right when
you call out their name.
In my experience, almost universally, by the time a worker comes to see an attorney, they've already contacted the employer. They may not have written a letter, certified mail return receipt requested, but they have talked to the employer. They don't, I mean, it's not the natural thing for someone to do to first run and see a lawyer. I mean, they've tried to work it out, and it just hasn't been possible to do that in the overwhelming number of cases, almost universal.
Sure.
Representative Leonard?
Sure. I'm suspecting that this conversation is going somewhat astray from the bill and what it's intended to address. In my reading of the bill and the reference it makes to an existing statute, which isn't in the bill, you have to go to the statute, 652.110, what the bill is talking about is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is where the employer has agreed he has a debt to employees and has paid the employee, for an example, by check, and the check has bounced. Correct me if I'm reading this statute wrong, and the check has bounced, or some other acknowledgement of indebtedness to the employee has occurred between the employer and the employee, and the employee then follows that up with some action to try to recover damages, wages acknowledged by the employer. And in that subsequent action, attorney fees that are accrued to the employee will then be paid by the employer. This isn't an original demand for wages, as I'm reading 652.110, which is referenced in this bill. This is making reference to wages that have been acknowledged are owed by the employer. These are not in dispute. We're not talking about somebody at some point in the future raising some claim. I mean, I don't think that's what this statute is speaking to. It's you've told me I owe you $10. I give you a check for $10. The check bounces. I go to court to get my money. That's the way the statute reads. In any action for the collection of any order, check, memorandum, or other acknowledgement of indebtedness referred to in ORS 652.110, when you go to 652.110, it basically says you pay the person in cash, and if you don't, you pay them with some negotiable instrument that they can get cash for without discount. And that's what it talks about.
Representative Leonard, if I may, you're referring to the provisions of subsection 1, which provide for attorney's fees for non-payment of wages in the circumstances you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
The amendment is to subsection 2,
mm-hmm.
and subsection 2 is in any action for the collection of wages. So any action for collection of wages, and that could be under the circumstances you're describing where the amount of wages is acknowledged, it might be where there is a dispute as to the amount of wages.
Whether or not wages are owed.
That's right. It could be.
But it could include also a bounced check.
Very well could include a bounced check. It could include the situation where the person's just not been paid at all.
Correct. Okay.
I've seen it come up where someone else claimed the paycheck and not the person who did the work,
mm-hmm.
And the person didn't receive a paycheck at all.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it come up where the farm was under hard times and chose to pay one debt instead of another, and the debt to the worker didn't get paid. I've seen it happen where it could be a question of payment of the minimum wage, where the amount tendered meets the requirements of the piece rate but doesn't meet the requirements of the minimum wage. All kinds of circumstances come up under this subsection 2.
I could just follow that up with my comment. But if a circumstance occurred where a farm worker was given a check and the check bounced, and the farm worker then went directly to an attorney and said, you know, this guy gave me a check, it bounced, under the provisions of this bill, if that farm worker did not give a written statement to the employer that the money is owed him, that weren't paid through the bounced check, he needed payment, or he would not be able to recover attorney fees if we passed.
That's correct. That's the way I read the bill. At that point, what would have to happen is the attorney would have to give the notice. And then, you know, it could be 6 months later. They could have argued about it for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
The employer could have refused to pay for 6 months. And at that point, where you'd be back to is the attorney would write the letter, and the employer could pay within 10 days and not be obligated for any attorney's fees at all. And it's not even clear in the bill that you'd have to pay the penalty wages.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear whether it would only be the payment of the unpaid wages, not the penalty wages as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Do you have another one? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. I've been working with, you know, some 200 lawyers over my past lifetime on a regular basis. I know we think differently, I perceive this scenario, well, in fact, I know it happens over and over and over again, so I'll just speak to it from a business viewpoint. An employee leaves employment. We have, you know, 24 hours to pay their whatever, you know, end of the term of employment wage. Okay. And they endorse this agreement that says, you know, paid in full and I will not claim anything else. Not, I mean, except in legal terms. Okay. Then about, 3-4 weeks later, the individual realizes that he was entitled to something else. Now, does this not occur?
I'm sure it does, yes.
Okay. So in this case, I'm thinking the employer then would like to be notified of this subsequent, as this says, subsequent wage claim. This individual was not aware of it the day he left the employment or was terminated, either one. I mean, it hadn't dawned on him that he was entitled. Aren't you thinking that is, I mean, can happen, and don't you think prior to attorney having to be called that this individual and the employer should be notified that this is happening before some attorney is hired on a buku contingency fee that like this. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I will agree that could happen. I apologize for chuckling. The BUCU contingency fees, wage claims for low-wage workers aren't BUCU contingency fees, and I wish...
The
way they work.
Mr. Chair, may I? Thank you. Follow-up. I mean, we're not speaking. Are we just speaking to low-income? I don't see that in this bill.
We're not. This would apply to all wages of all workers.
I mean, this applies to somebody working for Bill Gates who, you know, leaves. So I'm just saying, you know, I think that seems to be the circumstance, and I know it happens over and over again where really this instrument which we use as employers, because we want everything resolved the day the individual leaves us or quits to go with our competitor, take all our secrets, you know, that sort of thing, or it didn't work out, we want it to be resolved. And, you know, I think, you know, we do that thinking that, you know, we have done what is right. And I think, you know, what we're asking here is, you know, let's have, you know, communications before we file another enormous lawsuit or any lawsuit. I mean, the wages, I mean, we better pay the wages than the lawyers.
Representative Nelson, I react to that in two ways. The bigger issue in most of these cases than attorney's fees is the penalty damages. And in the situation you're describing, if the worker didn't know it, probably the employer didn't know it either. And if the employer didn't know it, then the non-payment would not be willful. Penalties under 150, under 652-150 are only assessable for willful non-payment of wages. And so in that instance, I think that there'd be a real incentive for the employee to raise it with the employer before court action anyway, because the employer's going to have a defense that it wasn't a willful non-payment of wages because he didn't know anything about it. So you're probably going to get what you want from that perspective. As a practical matter, I understand what you're saying, that is you'd like to have employees notify the employer before they go to an attorney. I'm here to tell you that the only employees virtually that are going to know that they're supposed to do this, particularly by certified mail, are people who have already gone to see an attorney. It's fine, we put it in the law that that's what people are supposed to do, but a lot of workers, the overwhelming majority of workers, are simply not going to know that until they go see legal counsel, unfortunately.
The last question, please, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the issue is, I wouldn't have known till Representative Leonard was so kind to read that statute. No worker's going to know that either, you know, and I certainly didn't even know it as an employer. So the issue is that you have with this just purely the certified mail. I mean, is that seems to be your issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that is not the only issue. The critical issue is that wages should be paid on time. If they're not paid on time, then the regime that the state's had in effect for 50 years or 60 years that says that you have to pay penalties if you don't pay on time ought to be in effect, and you ought not to get an extra 10 days or an extra 6 months if it takes that long to get to a lawyer and get the notice and then be able to pay the wages and not have to pay any penalties. That's my principal question with the bill. In the circumstances you're talking about, I don't think it's going to be an issue because it's going to be non-willful, non-payment, so there won't be a penalty problem. But that's not the situation I'm concerned about.
Thank you. We've got two more people that are going to testify, so let's hold any more questions until they get done speaking.
Thank you, Mr.
Dale. Appreciate it. Are you going to both be together, Rich Pepper and Steve Lanning, or separately? How are we doing this? Okay. Okay, anytime.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Peppers. I'm with the Service Employees International Union, Local 503, OPEU. And I'm here with some concerns about the bill in front of you. Written testimony is being handed out. Since you've been talking about the bill for a while, I won't spend a whole lot of time going over this. I'll just point out our three areas of concern with the bill. And One of them has not been addressed yet, the other two have. So it's the one of the main, oh, and by the way, in the area in which we would probably come in contact with this issue the most would be, we represent state workers, local government workers, and also some private nonprofit workers. It's most likely in the private nonprofit field where there would be an issue arising around this. In the case of probably some employees or an employee leaving, as long as they're still employed and represented by the union, we would handle any wage disputes through the grievance situation, grievance procedure. But if, after an employee leaves and has a wage dispute, that's when these issues would kick in. And our concern is, for at first, that the bill changes the burden of proof in a dispute from showing that it appears that the employee has willfully violated the contract of employment, which is current law, to showing that the plaintiff cannot willfully violate the contract of employment. In other words, it switches establishing the proof that there was a living up to the employment contract from the employer onto the employee. And that is a change that hasn't been addressed yet in this discussion. And it puts the employee in a situation of trying to prove a negative, which is a hard thing to overcome. The second area of concern is that the bill establishes a new requirement of a written demand for payment to trigger the possibility that an attorney could collect legal fees. You've had some discussion of this already, but our question would be that in many situations, employees may not be aware that they must file a letter to trigger attorney fees. In other words, they could be in a dispute with the employer, and the employer, knowing that a letter is necessary, may or may not mention that to the employee. But if they don't, the employee winds up having to go to an attorney where they then learn about this situation, needing a letter. But if they do go seek legal help, an attorney would have to first tell them that they need to send a letter, after which point, if the employer pays up, the employee is stuck with the attorney fees to that point. There's the investigation. There's the documentation of a case that an attorney may or may not want to do. The time of the attorney that the employee or the attorney would wind up having to take care of. This is probably an unanticipated consequence of the bill, but nonetheless one that would be of concern to us, that the employees would be forced basically into a legal situation rather than being able to address these things verbally beforehand. And then the third area of concern is the additional 10-day waiting period after a written request on top of the already existing 48-hour grace period. This creates a hardship for the employee who's waiting to be paid, first of all. And in many cases, especially in private nonprofits, pay level is not as close to minimum wage or just above. But it also gives the employer a chance to make payment and escape the consequences of non-compliance with an employee and employee's contract. Now, if the bill's basic intent is to do what was discussed here earlier, which is just to require that there's some kind of notification to the employer that there is a wage claim out there and a dispute over it, we would support that that needs to be the case, that there needs to be, the employer needs to be aware that there's a dispute. In any case that we can think of, the employer would almost certainly be aware through some verbal disagreement over whether the employee's been paid or not. So the written notice simply serves to give the employer then an idea that this is really serious and the employee is getting ready to go to court over it, which at that point then they may or may not resolve the dispute. But we think it would be better to resolve this dispute earlier when it's still at the verbal stage. So that's our testimony. If you have questions, I'm happy to try and answer them.
Yes, Representative Mifflin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there a possibility that this language creates an incentive for an employer to not pay employees? That is, maybe I can wait a couple days and see if I get a written notice. And if I do get a written notice, I have a week and a half to pay up anyway. Is that a possibility of changing this law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's one of our concerns. I'm sure it's not intended by the sponsor of the bill, but it is an issue that we would be concerned about occurring. it does create some perverse incentive.
Related question. I think it was, we had testimony earlier that probably this language doesn't change the penalty clauses of the law that would require payment of penalties if you're paying more than 48, I believe it's 48 hours applies there too. Is that your contention also, that if I was an employer and I did wait for the written letter and I did pay 10 days later, I would still owe, in addition to the basic wages, a penalty as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's how I read the bill, that it does apply simply to the question of the attorney fees rather than the penalties. Although I'm no attorney, I'm happy to be educated on that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 175,000 working men and women in Oregon. And I just want to echo what my union colleague, Rich Peppers, said, that we oppose this bill. The way that it's written, it does throw up some new obstacles to workers that feel that they haven't been paid. It has a new written demand that would be required, and then there's that additional 10-day waiting period that may come into play as well. We do support a notification, and it would be hard to imagine a case like this, especially with a subsequent claim, where an employer would not already know that there's a worker that feels that they haven't been paid the full amount. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any more questions?
Okay.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, did you see the amendments that were offered up by Michael Dale?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, no.
Okay. Well, you might take a look at those. They're probably on the table over there, and just give us some feedback about what your position is on those and if that changes anything for you. I don't think it does, but I'd ask you to look at those.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else testifying on House Bill 2500?
Since the Labor Commissioner is still in the audience, is it possible, without asking him to weigh on the bill, that I could just ask him a question?
Certainly.
A technical matter?
Certainly. He's happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roberts, you've been listening with rapt attention to the debate on this bill. My question is just how the bill would interrelate with the civil penalty scheme that your agency enforces, and specifically, if somebody comes to you for non-payment of wages, is there a 10-day grace period for employers right now to pay up without having to pay whatever penalties you can?
Mr. Chairman, Reserve Rosenbaum, again, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The provision that's being amended here has to do with attorney's fees. It doesn't really affect penalty wages as such. As a practical matter, when we get a final paycheck issue where it does involve penalty wages, we do request payment, and if it's promptly paid, we don't pursue the penalty wages. That's just our normal enforcement. If we have to go through our normal administrative procedure or have to go to court, we do try to collect the penalty wage. And if we go to court, we also try to get attorney's fees. There are a couple of problems that are presented by this bill, I think, from what we do. And I would say that I'm sympathetic with what's trying to be accomplished here, that we would all like to see amicable settlements and to move on. But we probably have a bigger concern about the certified or registered mail than Mr. Dale does, because when we get a wage claim, we always send out a notice for demand for payment. We do not typically send that out certified or registered mail. It would be costly to us because of the volume that we send out to do that. And if as a result of that, that then made it difficult later to collect attorney's fees either for us or if it's withdrawn and gone to private counsel, if that creates a problem, that would be a concern to us. And we would have to review our practice and see whether we wanted to then start sending all these notices out certified or registered, and that would be a cost constraint for us and a consideration. More broadly, I think there's a little bit of concern here about the potential that's been mentioned by several people that this could be an invitation to some of the less scrupulous people out there that unfortunately are still around, who might say, well, good, I don't have to pay until I get a demand, and then I have 10 days to pay. And this doesn't really address the issue. We have a different bill talking about the penalty wages, where we're trying to say if you pay upon demand, we might cap that at the 100% penalty that's the FLSA or the federal penalty, and the other penalty wage would continue only if you fail to pay. That's a different bill and a different issue. Here, it appears that if you don't send the notice first before you file, you are forever precluded from collecting attorney's fees. One other alternative way to look at this, and I think that some of the things that Michael Dale suggested, the tolling, the statute of limitations, we would have no problem with. And the other issue I think that he alludes to here, but if you had a requirement that the person had to tender the payment of the wages, and at that point would cut off any further attorney's fees, the cost of writing the letter or other things might still be liable for. But if you get the notice and you find that, and I, again, would not make it certified or registered, but I think if they get the notice and say, gosh, we did make a mistake, it's an honest mistake, and you pay, that should not, that seems to me should not then necessarily mean that the total cost of the collection at that point is on the employee, but the employer should be able to stop and not have to pay the cost of a full trial if it goes to that. Our experience has been, not only as at Boley, but my personal experience when I was attorney in private practice, is that most of these get resolved pretty quickly, and it's where the person, it's an honest mistake and you can deal with it, it's not hung up over the attorney's fees. If there are attorneys who are overreaching, there may be better ways to deal with that than what's set forth in this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to close the public hearing now on House Bill 2500. And that kind of wraps up our business today.
Mr. Chair, there were two members that were not here when we voted on the first bill today, Bill 2094. So perhaps they.
Why don't you open a work session on that?
Let's reopen a work session. Reopen a work session on House Bill 2094.
Representative Leonard and Representative Walker out here.
Representative Walker and Representative Leonard, would you like to vote on House Bill 2094?
Well, I wasn't aware I missed a vote.
I actually had a question about that before I cast a vote, if I could.
Yes.
I thought we were going to narrow the amendment on that one to shall. Instead, it looks like it got even broader than before. Anyone
respond
to that?
Mr. Chairman, I can comment on that. The effort to narrow that down is in amendment the dash two amendments, where arrangements are limited to health care services and assistance, including providing pharmaceuticals, treatment services, transport services, training assistance, security assistance, and tactical assistance. That was the language that was used to narrow that down.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Aye.
Did you take out the word may? Line 9.
They're doing us a favor here, Representative Walker.
I know. I just wanted to make sure that I understood this bill before I voted on it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, the word may remains there. It allows, it's permissive language that allows the Department of Corrections to enter into contracts, agreements, or arrangements with local governments.
Regarding those things outlined.
To provide this limited number of services that are specified in the dash two amendment.
All right. Thank you very much for that explanation. I appreciate the patience and the indulgence of my committee and the committee staff.
Sarah,
I vote aye.
You're on, sir.
Aye.
Good.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
And with that, we close the session on 2094. And we are all done. We close the meeting.
Thank you, Representative.